coming up on today's program.
If this is really taking a toll on your confidence, or if you are having anxiety, depression, that definitely impacts your mental health, and it's something that is super important to get counseling through as well.
Finding your voice. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. That story coming up on Translucent later in our program. Also in the next half hour, we'll hear the final segment of our series, One Small Step. Up first, Dayton's two leading dance companies, Dayton Ballet and Dayton Contemporary Dance Company, have been teaming up with local musicians for the Rhythm of the City, new works and original music that celebrates the city's artistic roots. The performances have been taking place this weekend and will continue today. They reflect a newly revived partnership between the two companies. As part of WISO's Culture Couch series on the local art scene, Brandon Ragland with the Dayton Ballet and Debbie Blunden Diggs of DCDC come together to discuss dance, collaboration, and rhythm of the city.
So, Debbie, what drew you to be in dance?
Oh, my God. That's such a long, long story. Let's start with the beginning. Actually, my mother is the founder of Dayton Contemporary Dance Company. And so what I say is that dance is in my DNA. I've been surrounded by it my whole life. I joined the company when I was 12. It's not the company it is now. So I grew up as the company grew up. And every time I thought I needed to step outside of DCDC for a different opportunity, those opportunities were coming in to us. Mm-hmm. What about you?
I started in church. And it was very interesting because I've always loved movement. I loved, you know, the social dances, learning the latest line dance. I was at a Boy Scouts meeting and I got done early and I went downstairs and heard this music and I saw all of these people dancing. And so I started mimicking in the hallway what they were doing. And the woman who was over it, she was so happy because she, you know, she saw a boy that interested in dance. So her eyes lit up and she said, "Are you here to audition for the dance ministry?" And I said, "I guess, sure." And she always talks about this. I still keep in touch with her to this day. And she was the one that took me to the Black College Dance Exchange. So she started exposing me to taking class with Catherine Dunham and Elio Parmer, like a lot of these Black artists that really inspired me to start taking dance more seriously.
Okay.
So through those experiences, I went to a fine arts high school. I went for math and science to begin with and begged my parents to let me switch over to dance. And so I switched over to dance and just from there, started to really, really dive into my ballet training. And that's where I fell in love with ballet. Here I am.
Yay, yeah. You. That's an interesting beginning. We've never talked about that. I never knew that about you.
To me, that's why interesting, like something that I, when I first came here and was learning about all of these deep traditions and histories that both Dayton Ballet and DCDC have together, led me to really want to connect with you again. Mm-hmm. and kind of reestablish that. And how has it been for you?
I mean, I think it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of time passed where there was no connection. And so, you know, I've wanted to for years to collaborate in some kind of way. And to have this opportunity speaks to you and your leadership and your understanding about origins, right?
Yeah. Well, and for me, it was a no-brainer. Like what also drew me to this job in Dayton and the arts community was that you have two, which is rare for one city. I don't think people realize that.
Right.
Two prevalent professional dance companies. And so I'm so happy to have a project like Rhythm of the City you know, taking shape.
I know, right?
Amazing.
It is.
It really is.
This thing that we're doing on the 10th, 11th, and 12th of April is really, really special. And the only way people will understand how special it is if they come and see it. If they come and join us, you got to be part of the party.
Yeah. Come be part of a
party. We're throwing a good party.
Yeah.
So this has been great. Thank you, Brandon. It's been a good conversation.
No, I really appreciate it. It's always a joy talking with you.
That was Brandon Ragland of the Dayton Ballet and Debbie Blunden Diggs of the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company. Rhythm of the City performances continue today. Find out more at DaytonLive.org. Culture Couch is produced by the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO. Our music selection this week comes from Cincinnati band Mavis Guitar. Travis Talbert, who plays pedal steel, talks with WYSO music director Juliet Frumholt about their music and new album.
Mavis Guitar, live on Kaleidoscope, on WYSO and Novaphonic. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us. This is great here. It's really awesome in this whole studio.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
You seem like you're enjoying it.
I am. Good. Yes, yes. I'm enjoying you guys studio. Absolutely.
It feels great.
Well, it's been a little while since you guys have been here.
Yeah, it was probably like 3 years ago, right?
I think so, yeah. How do you think you all have grown and evolved as a trio?
Well, we kicked Elijah. No, it's Elijah's still like one of my best friends. Love him to death. And it was just like we started as soon as we had the release show for that, and like we had everybody plan everything. I was starting to write some things on steel, and then the more that I kept working on them, it was more a challenge to myself to make it a trio where I had to fill out more of the melodic and kind of that whole area that I decided to not have another guitar or keys or anything like that. And I just wanted to keep it sparse and see like what I could make myself get out of. Like I like to back myself into a corner, I guess.
Force yourself to escape creatively.
It's really the only thing that works for me.
Well, I want to talk a little more about that filling out that melody line, because even just in those two songs, I heard you as a trio and the pedal steel in particular occupying so many different genre spaces and stylistic spaces. How are you thinking about your instrument these days and how it can drive melody lines that aren't just Americana or jazz or ambient? They're kind of many things.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's really like, I think we would all take that as a high compliment. I know what you mean. Like it kind of does get pigeonholed as a country instrument or something like that. And there's a really great steel player named Russ Paul that I really love, who's very inventive. And he's on lots of really popular records, but lots of things that like you wouldn't even realize he was playing pedal steel on. And he looks at it more as like a tone generator.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of do the same thing, I think. Like that was what initially drew me to it, was that it is a guitar, but the way that you can make voices, each string can kind of like, one can go up and one can go down at the same time. You can make it very, like almost like a choir underneath the bar. I just kind of look at it like that, like a guitar, because it is. It's just only got one fret. And a lot of these I wrote on this instrument specifically, but then some things I still just wrote on a guitar. Like one of the songs on the record I wrote on piano.
Mm.
And then I kind of like forced myself to figure out how am I going to make that work on here with this combination. But then like both Will and Nick are bringing so much to the songs that I never even imagined that like really does fill it out. We've just known each other so long. I just trust them inherently that I know I can get really squirrely and weird and they're going to be fine and they'll follow wherever I want to go. So I mean, that's the basic gist of how we're thinking of it.
It's got to be, I feel like perhaps, and maybe this is because I'm a singer, so instrumental music is something I enjoy, but not something I know how to create. It feels like to not have vocals sort of driving that melody, you need to have so much trust between the players to have that musical nonverbal language.
I think that's true. I mean, I still think of a singer as just as much of an instrument. And, you know, like when I'm playing with a singer, I know that the job is to just support, mm-hmm. like you support what's ever out front. And that could be different things. Like sometimes the bass is out front and sometimes the drums are out front. And, you know, like everybody occupies whatever space is necessary in the ensemble.
Tell me about your new album. It's called Pedal Steel Trio and it'll be out April 17th. Are these songs that have been with you guys for a while or all relatively new material?
Well, I mean, we have been working on it for, I mean, kind of in between the rest of what we do for like two and a half years. And then some of them, the next song we're going to play is for my daughters, and it's called Ralph and the Wheel. And this one has existed for at least 10 years because Ellie is going to turn 10 in a few weeks. Tomorrow is Hazel's birthday. Hazel is the wheel. I didn't explain that.
Oh, okay.
Hazel's the wheel. Ellie is Ralph.
Okay.
That's what I call him. And that one has existed for a long time, but I did it originally like on a Weisenborn. And then I don't know, like the more that these kept going, I started to get, like I had a song for kind of every member of my immediate family. So one for my wife, both of my sons, and then, both of my daughters, even though they're sharing a song and they are a little, they're a little particular about that sometimes. So, but that was where I was in my life at the time when I wrote that one. But then the rest of them are kind of the way that I best can express myself. And I know this is strange to say in an interview where I'm talking, but I do feel like these express like the way that I feel better than I can talk about how I feel.
That makes sense.
That's a lot of what I said when I was in therapy.
Well, I mean, you have said on this show, and I've seen you say at other places, that Mavis guitar is kind of a meditation.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. I mean, it, you know, if anybody else gets something out of it, that's great. But like, that's really what I'm going for, is just to like zone out and not have to think about my own thoughts for as long as the song goes on. I like that feeling.
Mavis Guitar's new album is called Pedal Steel Trio. It'll be out April 17th, and you can celebrate their release with them on April 19th at Southgate House Revival. Where can folks go if they want to get the album / keep track of where you guys are going to be, what you're doing next?
Yeah, if they want to get the record, it's on mavisguitar.bandcamp.com, and you can pre-order that now. We would very much appreciate it if you pre-order it. And then if you just follow on, mainly on Instagram, it's Mavis Guitar. There is a Facebook page that I don't follow along with nearly as well, but Mavis Guitar.
Well, before we send people off to mavisguitar.bandcamp.com to pre-order the album, would you play some more live ones for us?
Yeah, this is Ralph and the Wheel.
Thanks again so much, guys.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. The show is also available as a podcast. Thank you for listening and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. Up next, for transgender people, a voice can be more than just speech, and it can shape how they're heard, seen, and understood by the world. In this episode of Translucent, Lee Wade talks with a local speech therapist about the importance of voice in transgender lives.
Hi, I'm Lee Wade, and you're listening to Translucent, a series that amplifies trans voices, humanizes our community, and creates space for the real everyday conversations that don't make headlines. Today, we're talking about something many of us use every day, our voice. I'm a trans man, and I've been on testosterone for about 6 years now, and my voice hasn't really dropped. I still deal with voice dysphoria, and I still get misgendered just from how I sound. To help us understand how voice therapy fits into gender-affirming care, I'm joined by Marissa Nguyen. She's a speech-language pathologist based in Dayton who specializes in voice and swallowing rehabilitation, including gender-affirming voice therapy. She sees every day how important voice can be in someone's transition.
It can be very debilitating for people to not have the voice that they are looking for that matches with who they are as a person. With the vocal exercises we are doing, we are physically changing the way that the muscles are working. So think of it like physical therapy, for example.
Nguyen says voice isn't just about sound. It's tied to identity, safety, and well-being.
We do encourage people like going through gender-affirming voice therapy or either other types of voice therapy, like, hey, if this is really taking a toll on your confidence, or if you are having anxiety, depression, just because of the way your voice sounds, like you can have that dysphoria to your voice, that definitely impacts your mental health. And it's something that is super important to get counseling through as well.
Nguyen says hormones also shape what's possible. Estrogen won't change the vocal cords, so trans feminine and some non-binary patients rely on therapy to reach a higher pitch. Testosterone, in contrast, thickens the vocal cords and often lowers the voice on its own. No matter the goal, Nguyen says most people can learn to shape their voice into something that feels more like them.
I see it a lot where after a few sessions, patients are coming in and they're like, wow, I feel really good about my voice. Like, I don't think I need you anymore. Like, I think I know what I need to do. And they gain that confidence.
Nguyen teaches patients how to work with three systems of the voice: breath support, vocal cords, and resonance, the part that shapes the quality of the sound.
Pitch is not everything when it comes to our voice. Resonance, that filter, also plays a big role. So we will work with people a lot of times on resonance and also articulation. So for example, my trans feminine leaning patients, they might want something that's a little lighter or brighter that allows them to be perceived as more feminine.
During our session, she walked me through some of the same exercises she gives her patients.
First thing I would have you do, if you're looking for a little more bass in your voice, go ahead and just briefly hold out an Think of that like you're holding your vocal cords in a plank position or a wall sit, where it is forcing them to stay in one posture or position and just vibrate. I want you to do a hum. Think of like a pop of air voice, like lots of space in the back of the throat and the back of the mouth. And we're going to do a mm. Go ahead and try that and think like lots of space in the back of the throat.
Mm.
So starting with a hum as a little primer. So mm. And then leading into saying things that you would normally say in your day. So for me, maybe like a hi, how are you? And carrying that over. Go ahead and try that.
Hi, my name is Lee.
Yeah, exactly like that. So that's the beauty of voice, is that we talk all day long. These are all opportunities every time we're talking to alter the way our voice sounds.
Thank you, Marissa Nguyen, for helping us better understand voice therapy. I'm Lee Wade, and thank you for listening to Translucent.
Translucent is supported by the Ruby Girls Foundation and Square One Salon and Spa. You can find more episodes online at WYSO.org. As you know, together with StoryCorps, WYSO invited community members to take part in One Small Step, bringing people from across the region together for conversations with someone they've never met. In this final episode, we meet Paul Wesselman of Cincinnati and Carrie Scarf of Dayton. They met at WYSO's Chuck Berry studio in downtown Dayton and found they shared a sense of despair about the state of the world. Through books, they came together to see those feelings are connected to caring deeply, and that hope is something you actively choose rather than wait for.
It is understandable why there is so much despair right now. And I don't know if you're familiar with Joanna Macy's, this book, Act of Hope. She was an environmental climate change person and started talking about conflict resolution. And she came up with this interesting model around hope and how important it is, even when times are hard, especially when times are hard, to be able to maintain a hopeful outlook. Because plenty of people say for me to be hopeful is naive. And I think I know what naive hope looks like. And I think I'm very not naive. I think the world's a big mess. I think it's going to get worse. I think we might be somewhere with climate change that we're past so many tipping points that there's really nothing left to do but fix things enough to make the downfall a little less awful. You know, it could be that bad. Democracy. I think there's hope that our country recovers from this. You know, I hate to have a microphone in front of me when I say, I don't think it's years. I think it's probably decades. I think, you know, when you look at things, the way things are stacked right now is not going to be easy to undo. And our country's history is measured in centuries and not decades and not years. And the history of civilization is measured in thousands of years. Existence of humans, hundreds of thousands of years, possibly millions. More, right? Millions. This is our little experiment is that little, you know, that little tip of a finger. Do we somehow get through this? Sure. Mm-hmm. If we are making decisions that are making it inhospitable for humans to stay on this planet, does the planet recover? Oh, yeah. And have we possibly torn through our lease and we're going to lose our deposit? It's possible. And Mother Earth is going to be just fine.
And yeah. And, you know, it's interesting also, another book that I read recently that gave me hope was A Gentleman in Moscow.
Mm.
It was a gentleman in Moscow at the beginning of the Bolshevik Revolution. He was part of the aristocracy. And he was arrested and should have been killed, but they thought he wrote a poem in support of the revolution. And so they let him live, but he was confined to the Moscow hotel. And it was a story of the next 3 or 4 decades of him living in this hotel while this whole revolution that was supposed to be so liberal and so supportive of all the people ended up turning on the people.
Right.
And what I took from it is all of the humanity was still there on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people were good. Even the people mm-hmm. who were out executing this new government that was doing a lot of horrible things, when engaged on a personal level, were good people.
Yeah.
And as I watch what's happening in the country, I know that my life, my friends, even the ones who think differently than me,
mm-hmm.
you know, is still full of people who are good and caring and kind. And I take the opportunities that I have to stay hopeful,
mm-hmm.
to stay strong, to stay informed, so that when the time comes, I am not beaten down by the despair, but strengthened by what's around me to act and make the difference that I can.
That was Carrie Scarf and Paul Wesselman. One Small Step with WYSO is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and presented by the Charles F. Kettering Foundation. Up next on WYSO Weekend, a century ago, aviation was taking off in a big way. From the early days of the Wright Flyer to planes flying higher and faster than anyone thought possible, Thanks to innovations like General Electric's turbo supercharger, those breakthroughs became crucial in World War II and helped spark aviation growth in Southwest Ohio, especially around Wright Field. Dan Patterson has that story.
Flying and the men and women who fly can tell you that faster, higher, and further is a part of why they fly. And a century ago, the sky was literally the limit. The 1903 Wright Flyer had a 12-horsepower motor, and it would fly at a speed not too much faster than a bicycle might go. By the time they were demonstrating their inventions in 1909, their motor developed 40 horsepower, and they flew at over 40 miles an hour. 100 years ago, and 8 years after the crucible of World War I, Jimmy Doolittle won the Schneider Cup race with an average speed of 232 miles an hour, with an engine that was 565 horsepower. That was at sea level. The quest for higher required another solution than just raw power. General Electric was developing the turbo supercharger. Dr. Sanford Moss was the engineer driving the project. The theory was that in addition to an aircraft engine, which could force sea-level pressure air into the engine, would allow it to run as if it were at sea level. The simple description is to take the exhaust already being created by the engine, run it through pipes into a compressor, which is spinning at very high speed, increasing the air pressure, and pipe that back into the carburetor, sea-level air pressure. Bingo! That required very high-temperature metals, very precise machining, and assemblies which GE had the ability to produce. Dr. Moss needed to test the system at high altitude, and in 1918 they decided on Pikes Peak in Colorado, over 14,000 feet. All that was mounted on Ford Model T trucks, which were not supercharged, and they couldn't get to the top. Isn't it ironic that all of the test equipment to prove that high-altitude flight was possible was then hauled to the mountaintop with teams of draft horses? After a lot of fits and starts, the test was a success. The Liberty engine was producing the same horsepower as it did at sea level. Without the supercharger, the engine was struggling to get half of that. The testing now continued back here at McCook Field. GE-equipped Liberty motors were fitted to Packard LePere biplanes and test flown over and around Dayton. The results were pretty amazing, with test pilots John McCready and Rudolph Shorty Schroeder continuing to set and break their own records. By the way, Shorty was the nickname he was given, as he stood at 6 feet 4 inches tall. In 1921, McCready flew the supercharged LePere to over 40,000 feet. On that flight, he briefly removed his flight goggles while adjusting his oxygen system, essential at that altitude. His eyeballs immediately froze, blind, at 33,000 feet. He passed out due to lack of oxygen, and the aircraft plummeted nearly 6 miles. He regained consciousness at the lower altitude and got it back under control. Now nearly totally blind as his eyeballs thawed out, Schroeder was able to make it back to McCook Field and land safely. He had to be lifted from the cockpit. These accomplishments led to the equipment, which became standard equipment on the airplanes that flew and fought World War II at altitudes well over 25,000 feet. For example, each B-17 and B-24 had 4 engines. Each engine had 1 turbo supercharger. The numbers are staggering. Over 12,000 B-17s were built and over 18,000 B-24s. In rough numbers, that's 30,000 bombers, with original equipment of 120,000 superchargers. And then spares and replacements had to be made as well. GE and its aviation division was running full speed. The expertise, which General Electric had perfected in metals and machining, is why they were selected to build the first operational jet engines at the end of the war, and which is why GE took over the huge manufacturing facility, which was empty, to build a jet engine production facility near Cincinnati in the late 1940s, just an hour drive from Dayton. McCook Field had evolved into Wright Field and would eventually become Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and the moths to the flame continue to come here. For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
This is Bird Note. Mother Goose sounds old-fashioned, so let's bring her story up to date. Everyone knows Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty. They're Disney stories, right? Not exactly. 3 centuries before they helped make Disney famous, they were among the original Mother Goose tales. And hundreds of classic nursery rhymes, like Three Blind Mice and Humpty Dumpty, were also first gathered under Mother Goose's wing. Such stories and rhymes were long part of Europe's oral folklore. The stories were first published in France in 1697 as Tales of My Mother Goose. The book appeared in English soon after. Just who or what was Mother Goose? The name originates in an old French euphemism. Stories told by elder women were called Tales Told by Mother Goose. Mother Goose was sometimes illustrated as an old country woman wearing a tall hat and riding on the back of a goose, or sometimes as just a big motherly goose wearing reading glasses and a bonnet, a friendly figure children could trust. There's something timeless about big feathery friends for children, even today. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
Bird Note, putting a wrap on this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. And the series is available as a podcast wherever you get your podcast from. Please subscribe and share. I'm Jerry Kenney. We've got more conversations and highlights for you next weekend. Please join us then.